You know, ever since I was a little kid, I'm serious about this. Maybe it's just the dark side of the Piscean thing. I felt like I was getting in on the end of something. And I asked my father, a Pearl Harbor veteran, who was attacked on the USS Maryland on the very battleship my grandfather, after whom I am named, helped build. I said, Dad, your dad, my grandfather, predicted the war with Japan 10 years before it happened. What do you predict? And he gave a little wan smile and he said, the thing about the next one is, you won't know who you're fighting. And that stayed with me for about 20 years. Our next guest is Joel Skousen, publisher of the World Affairs Brief, a weekly news analysis service found at worldaffairsbrief.com. If you want to check it out, Mr. Skousen is a political scientist by training, speaks multiple foreign languages. He uses this in accessing information here and abroad. He specializes in helping his readers understand the hidden agenda of those that secretly control both political parties and the U.S. government. He also has a second career as the chief designer at the Secure Home Design Group, which specializes in helping people design and implement high-security residences and retreats. He's written several books in that field of security architecture, and I want to talk to this man, and I know that you're going to want to listen to him and talk to him, too. In for George Norrie, this is John B. Wells, Coast to Coast, AM. Glad to be with you tonight. Joel Skousen, are you on the line with us? I certainly hope so.
I am, John. It's good to be with you. I was able to listen to some of your interview with Lauren Weissman and found it very interesting. I do have a couple of things I'd like to add that I think he missed, if you have time for that.
Absolutely. That energy drink is finally worn off a little bit, thank God. So you just go ahead and take the floor and just go ahead and address those points right now, if you like.
Let me talk a little bit about profiling, because I've not only been to Israel many times, I've talked to Israeli security about the way that they profile, and it isn't really profiling that the ACLU and others are complaining about here. It isn't racial profiling. It isn't religious profiling. It's much more complex, and it's much more effective. What they do is do initial profiling and picking out people who have, it's not by race, it's by nervous condition. Everyone who is a suicide bomber is someone who is unstable, and they read instability. And that's a very important difference than just racial profiling, which seems to be so obtuse. This is very sophisticated, and it's very easy to detect, in fact. One security guard told me, he says, look, I can brush by, and that's why they use dogs, not so much to sniff out explosives, but the dog will initiate the nervousness in the suicide bomber much quicker than any other thing, including the questions. But they can get up close to that person. They can start to question, immediately start to hear the quivering in the voice and the difficulty of looking them in the eye, and it becomes very easy to pull that person out of the line, and they only do enhanced security screening on people who fail these basic and very quick profiling. It doesn't take a lot of questions, and they can spot most of them just by watching the line. And then they can zero in on the ones that are really the problems very quickly. And, Lauren was right about the fact that there are a lot more people that we process through this, and it does take much more expertise. You can't just take people at $10 an hour, off the streets as TSA people. It takes sophisticated training to do this, but it's very, very effective, and they've never had a breach of their security because of this profiling.
So I take it the drugs, one of these would-be bombers might ingest would not suppress these symptoms?
Well, they can tell that too. And and that's very easy to see, though, is when a person's got that dull look and the eyes are dilated and other things that he's been drugged down. They're trained to see that as well.
Why are we not doing this here?
I think it's because, and that's what I wanted to go into, he reacted to your question about whether you sense that there's any ulterior motives, conspiratorial issues. And he says, well, I never ascribe to conspiracy. What we can ascribe to stupidity. I have the opposite reaction. I never ascribe to stupidity when I see a repeated pattern of doing unreasonable things by government in the face of massive public resistance. That tells me there has to be an ulterior motive here. Has to be a reason for continuing to push this thing upon the American people, even against massive resistance. And let me offer some of those. to you. First of all, I think there is and needs to be an excuse, because every country that engages in eventual taking down of the financial freedom of the individual, especially about taking money offshore and getting and escaping high taxation, as South Africa did, as every other country that has clamped down its borders and said, you can leave, but you can't take your money with you. They need these kind of back scatter x-ray machines to be able to keep people from putting their money on their body and secreting that across the border. That's one reason. Secondly, I think they have to, and they have a desire to ferret out dissent in the United States. It's very interesting to see the training that some of these TSA supervisors have gone into. First of all, they want to, we know now that they keep lists of people who resist these things. You're getting on a list. They're taking names of people who will not submit, who will not be sheep to these types of things. Even they were told, and they have been trained to say and tell people who complain about their rights, these people, above all, go on a special list. And they tell them, you have no rights when you enter this area. They've been trained. They tell TSA employees that this is TSA property, it doesn't belong to the state, it doesn't belong to the airport, it belongs to the TSA, and nobody can even leave without our permission. And for them to leave, in fact, they have to be rousted out in a very rough manner by the police, and most of them are thrown to the floor and handcuffed and then marched out of the security area.
So they wind up on a lift. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think the only reason for doing this, John, is to exacerbate the injustice. In other words, to spark a reaction. They love this site, you know, don'tfly.com, because they want to see, in fact, who's signing up for this, who's offering resistance. I think they're making lists. They're very much after dissidents. We know this from the FBI surveillance. They've been after dissidents. We know this from the way that they cordoned off places of free speech zones whenever people want to protest. And yet, for example, in London, they have agent provocateurs dressed in black with the black hoods to go and break glass to give police the excuse to move in against protesters. And yet, when it comes to real legitimate protesters, they keep them cordoned off. There's all kinds of evidence that there is an exacerbation of tension between people versus tyranny and government, and they're ferreting out and trying to find out who are the potential dissidents, who are not the sheep. We want to know who are the people who are potential resistors someday. That's what worries me.
What do they
relative to a police state?
What do we do? What do they do then, Joel? Fill up the FEMA camps with them? You know, I've been hearing this stuff since the 80s about all these FEMA camps that are being built and can't get close to them. And you know, even Ventura's got into the act. You know, and actually, some of the stuff he comes up with is pretty interesting. I mean,
yeah, it really is. You know, I'm in my World Affairs brief. Often, one of the first things I did. When I started the World Affairs Brief prior to Y2K, was to search down and hunt down some of these lists on the internet about 300 and some camps, and they were mostly bogus. In fact, I really wonder about the legitimacy of the people. It was very obvious that they'd never even gone to some of these places they claimed were camps, and I did do the due diligence. I ran around all around the West. I visited all the former World War II camps, the ones that they said were being refurbished. Not a single one was being refurbished. Now, that said, I think a lot of this was perhaps disinformation on the web trying to discredit the idea that there would ever be camps to make it laughable. That's the same thing that happened in the Glenn Beck program when he claimed that he had, in fact, had evidence, he said, on Fox and Friends the day before he was going to go on the show about the FEMA camps, that his professional research staff had brought him information. In fact, I could not debunk this. And then he gets on the show the very next day, and he debunks it. And I said, what happened here? Well, sure enough, when he came out and showed that his expert independent team was none other than Mr. Meigs of Popular Mechanics, a professional shill and professional debunker of all things conspiratorial, was his source, then I realized, oh, he's been fed a hill of beans. In fact, there are detention camps, and they didn't bring out any of the things that I had published in the World Affairs Brief for years. I mean, the one that are visible, the ones that are on military bases. Nellis Air Force Base has a major detention camp. It can be viewed from the freeway. I've even been to the gates. I've talked to them about how many prisoners they have in and seen the facilities. And it was right 2 years ago on the Federal Bureau of Prisons list as a prison camp. And 2 years ago, they took it down, and they took it off the list. It's not there anymore, but it still exists, and it's still manned. I've been there. Now, why didn't that information get into Glenn Beck? Well, it's because that he, you know, I think Glenn Beck is sincere, but he was obviously easy to control by the staff, whoever put him on to Jim Meigs at Popular Mechanics as the experts, carefully let him down the primrose path. We've never, for example, been able to determine, because it's classified as the Brown and Root contract of some $400 million to build detention camps, and no one in Congress has been able to find out where those are being built.
Is KBR in on that too?
Pardon me?
Is that outfit KBR? Do you have any information on on their involvement also?
KBR, Halliburton, Brown and Root. That's the the outfit that's building that. And literally, they will not respond to any of my inquiries as to where the camps are being built. The Congress is not able to get any information, but the money has been given out to them. Now, so I have to ask the question, if there are no camps, then why the secrecy? Why the refusal to tell people what's going on here? I want to go back very quickly before we leave the airport scanner to have one important point that your guest really missed big, and that was the indications, the very powerful indications, there were provocations that created this. You know, he talked about there was the underwear bomber, there was the shoe bomber, but in either case, he failed to mention that there was one indication that indicated these were not true terrorists, and that is that everyone who deals with explosives, everyone, even the most lowly Marine, knows that you can take C4 off mortar shells. They have them rubber banded around the mortar shells, and you take off tabs of C4 depending on how much of a trajectory you want to give the mortar shell when it goes out. And they take the extra C4 tabs, and they light them with a match to cook their sea rations. Now, if a Marine knows that you can't light C4 and get it to explode with a match, then how are we to believe that these supposed terrorists trained overseas were not told that you have to have a blasting cap to set it off? And you even have, if you want to use a match, you have blasting caps that have a little fuse on it. They weren't given a blasting cap. They were told to light the C4 with a match. That indicates to me this was not intended ever to be an explosion. This is only intended to be a provocation to goad the American people into accepting these kinds of airport scanners. And not only did it happen once, it happened twice. And there's no terrorist organization in the world that would have accepted it the second time and sent the crotch bomber in with the same flawed explosive device.
Now, you're getting me all jacked up here, I'm telling you. So here comes a bunch of... This is like firing the shotgun out the back door. We're going to hit a bunch of stuff. I just don't know what, but probably most of it. Are we experiencing what they call in the intelligence community a waterfall? Little threats, little bombs, the Chilean embassy. Oh, here's one at the Greek embassy. Oh, here's one in Italy. Is this just a worldwide distraction technique? And if so, can you offer any theory as to, are the people that are... I think I'm just about to answer my own question. Are the people who are the actual terror mongers the ones with the full Windsor ties, the multinational types and the people in the highest levels of government? And are those levels of government that I'm trying to identify, are they the ones that have the conversations with the new presidents when they come in, and after that conversation, shortly after they take office, those presidents are never quite the same? And can we identify them? Because somebody is orchestrating this, and apparently it's above the authorities that we see on television and in other media.
Well, it's absolutely true, and I think I can answer a lot of that. I have stories from actual presidents who have met with people like Henry Kissinger. It happened to the president of Spain, José María Aznar, rather neophyte into politics. He said openly in a television interview or radio interview, he said, the powers that be met with me and asked me to run for office. And after the interviewing host got over his apoplexy about the powers that be, he was a leftist. He didn't believe that there were powers that be. And he said, the heads of the major parties, the labor unions, the banks, they got together with me, leaders of those things, and asked me to run and said they would support me and provide me the money. He just, this interviewer was Iñaki Gabilondo, who was the Walter Cronkite of Spanish television. I was there in Spain and heard that, and he said, I just can't believe this. We have powerful forces coaching you and helping you to become president. And after he got over his extreme exasperation, he finally asked him, well, Mr. President, who was your first visitor today as new president of Spain? And he said it was Henry Kissinger. And again, Gabilondo had this extreme reaction. Well, Henry Kissinger, he doesn't even speak Spanish. What was he here telling you or talking to you about? And José María Aznar said, he was explaining to me how the world worked.
So we're no longer really ignoring this, or are we? Because it's, you know, through persons like yourself and, is this being exposed sufficiently to create some sort of a groundswell of opposition to this global movement, or are we
this should be explosive, John. But let me give you an example of what happened. November 27th this year, Lord James Blackheath said in the House of Lords, he was talking about the fact that there's this secret foundation that's extremely wealthy that had let him know that they were offering to pay off the British debt in exchange for some other, you know, contractual obligations. And one of the other members of the House of Lords piped up and said, no, this organization wouldn't have talked to you. You're not high enough up in the government. So in other words, this other House of Lords member challenged Lord Blackheath about whether or not this powerful organization would ever talk to him. And in justification that he was important enough, he let out a blockbuster that got published in the British press, especially in the Irish press. He said, look, they will talk to me because I was none other than the person who laundered through the Bank of England, at the bequest of the Bank of England, over £1 billion in money for the IRA. Now, here's an open admission from a person in the House of Lords in public that he had, through the auspices of the Bank of England, laundered over £1 billion on behalf of the IRA. This goes right along with the other things that I reported on the World Affairs Brief a couple of years earlier, that Kevin Maguire, the number two man in security in the IRA, turned out to be a British agent. And then the fact that he had authorized the death of other British agents that had been captured by the IRA. And then the fact that it blew up in their face that the British government was running the IRA and creating terror against their own people, and to justify a great deal of the things that our own government is justifying through this false flag group of terror events. Now, you would think this would be blasted all over the press, something like a member of the House of the Lord admitting that the British government, through the Bank of England, had laundered £1 billion of money for the IRA. And it only got into the Irish press, and it never got here to the States, into the press.
Well, isn't a bunch of our money actually through the Afghani president being funneled right directly to Al-Qaeda? That's the latest thing that I've heard, is that our money that's being routed into Kabul is winding up as payoffs for people who we identify as terrorists. I guess that's to keep the machine greased up and running?
Well, unfortunately, we find that there's a great deal of evidence that terrorism at the highest levels, not at the lower levels, but at the highest levels of what they call the mythical Al-Qaeda, is in fact a government black operation that's been run mostly through Saudi Arabia. And there's been a great deal of payoffs, through the CIA, through Saudi Arabia, through the ISI in Pakistan, which in fact are paying off these things through drug money and other things. It's a big, complicated story.
Well, we're going to get into some more of it. And as soon as we get into anything you want to pull the cord on, just sing out and we won't go there. But I got a feeling we're already on somebody's list. John Wells in for George Norrie. This is the one and only Coast to Coast AM. Thanks to Mr. Norrie for letting me sit in his chair tonight from Dallas, Texas, down in Texas for the holiday time. And we have Joel Skousen with us. Back in the day, Joel, I did a lot of voiceovers for television stations. And I began to anger them one after another. One did a report, not in the state, north, the one that provides all the gravity for Texas, we say down here. And they did a story on legally owned submachine guns and things like that, and cast it in not a very pleasant light. And then I just happened to be channel surfing, and I saw a live feed from the ABC affiliate here in Dallas. Said live right down there at the bottom. This was during the Waco siege, and I began to wonder, gee, if it's live, why are all these edits occurring in a live feed? And later on, I got hold of a videotape that had the unedited version. It was much different. I was wondering, what's that stuff flying through the wall? And it looked to me like somebody tossed a grenade in behind a couple of ATF agents all dressed up like Waffen FS. But anyway, I guess where I'm going with this is, what's going on with our media? Why is it like this? Who is controlling them? And why are they enabling the populace to ignore all of this? Just, I mean, as a people.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting question. I used to believe, kind of growing up in a conservative community with a conservative family. My uncle was W. Klingenskausen, a renowned constitutional scholar who did so many works on promoting the Constitution. And I began to, you know, be raised with the general perception that the media was leftist. And it was because if they were socialist and leftist that they would always take certain positions. But now I have a different point of view, having been in the media myself for so many years. I realize that the media really is shilling for government. In fact, I found out that almost every investigative, in fact, without exception, every major investigative reporter that's ever got a Pulitzer Prize has been on the payroll of the government. They pick the people that they will give secrets to, that they will let do stories, who let into the White House to get these insider books. Nobody writes the books about the CIA, about the Mossad, or anyone, unless they're chosen to do so. During the Elian Gonzalez fiasco, where they sent this little boy back to Cuba at the behest of Cuba, it was very interesting. It came out, in fact, that there was a meeting between the heads, and this actually made the alternative media. There was a meeting between the heads of a lot of the major news sources about how they were going to treat this Elian Gonzalez. In other words, we caught them colluding about how they were going to run the story. So the major media really does have an agenda. Now you say, well, what about Fox News? It's, you know, clearly right-wing. But in fact, it's run by Rupert Murdoch, who has a lot of globalist connections. And I think it's been set up, frankly, as the controlled alternative. It was just like they control both political parties, give you a team A and a team B, but no difference in actual government policy. There'd been no change after Clinton when Bush took office, and there was no change from Bush when Obama took office, to the consternation of a lot of people who voted for Obama. And I think that's the reason, is that this is a controlled opposition.
So no matter what, whether it's right in control or left in control, there seem to be three levels here. We have the people down here who are like the ultimately the victims. You know, they say in every war, though, it's always the wrong people get killed. So we have the citizens down here, and then we have our government, and then we have those above them. And it seems like no matter who is actually in power, there may be some diversionary things like, oh, well, we're going to, so there's, you know, 300 million people in the country. Actually, there's more than that, but, you know, 30 million Americans are without health care. Well, it's like, well, that means that 270 million of them have it, but you're going to soak all of us for it. So we get all up in arms in that. But regardless of who's on, George Bush did this, and look, he stuttered, and look, he's an idiot, and blah, 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 and all of that. But at the end of the day, the ship is still sailing in the same direction as it was, regardless of which party is in office.
Absolutely true, and we only have the illusion of change. I mean, we're getting ready, for example, to have a switch to partial Republican control. But if you look very closely at how they're attempting to control the Tea Party movement and isolate the ones that really are going to try to make a change, I mean, we just saw during this lame duck Congress how Senator George Mitchell and John Boehner, the Republican leader, sold out essentially on everything that the Pledge to America had promised that they wouldn't do, including, you know, pork barrel politics and all kinds of spending that was going to be increased. They allowed us to get back into the dreaded estate tax at a whopping 35%. when it was down to zero already. I mean, they gave up some tremendous things, and they didn't even have to make this deal on taxes before the end of the year. They could have waited till they got into office in January and made it retroactive to January 1st, because nobody pays taxes on this year's income until a year and a half from now.
Right.
So they gave us all these excuses of why they had to compromise in order to get the best deal that they could before December 31st, and it was an absolute lie, and most people bought into it.
Let me ask you something. Just shifting around here, this is, I like to think that there's some structure to our interview here, but this is really more of a conversation, so we can do whatever we want and discuss whatever we want up to a point, I suppose. We'll discuss whatever we want. Seems to me like before you can have, I keep mentioning the Nazis, before you can have that, before you can have communism, before you can have a tyrannical regime of any kind, seems to me like you have to have broke people. Do you feel, or do you sense, or do you see a trend developing that would indicate that the way to get this country under control is to make it a nation of broke people?
Well, there's a lot to that, John. If we take you back to the history of pre-World War II, in the Weimar Republic, we have to ask, you know, how did this happen where the German currency went from being one of the strongest currencies to a basket currency of hyperinflation that was doubling and tripling, you know, every 2 or 3 days? And it was interesting that it ended up being a lot of the Wall Street banker advisors that were sent over to the Weimar Republic that induced them to engulf the country in inflation. It's my opinion, because these are the same people that funded a lot of Hitler's coming out of power, they needed this kind of breaking the people economically, and it did absolutely what they intended to do. It paved the way for the inroads of socialism, and communism was allowed and thrown into the act as well to give the socialists someone to parry off of, to have an evil opposition that they could justify taking upon themselves draconian powers. I mean, that's why they had a person faking communism burn down the Reichstag, the German parliament, in order to justify the draconian tyrannical powers that Adolf Hitler would accrue to himself in response. And that's exactly the same purpose that 9/11 served for the United States. And there's a tremendous amount of evidence of government, in fact, nothing of the crucial effects of taking down the towers could have occurred without government involvement. And that's why there's so much cover-up. There's so much denial of evidence. There's so much denial to the public. And why would the government have any reason to deny the public anything about the investigation unless they were covering for some type of involvement in this major Pearl Harbor event that provoked so much of the demise of our liberty in this country?
You know, on a previous show, we touched on this, and I've just made the assertion that do I think that the government is capable of doing something like orchestrating the assault on the Twin Towers? Oh, absolutely. Do I believe that they did? And this has been a couple of 3 years ago. Not at this time, but I got to tell you, at this time, I think it's undeniable. And I mean, I've seen all those tapes on, not all of them certainly, but enough of them, on Building 7. Oh, look, the penthouse is there. Oh, look, the penthouse is not there. Oh, the one that it's not there is the one that the government agency released. What happened to the top of the building? And over the years, I've seen a lot of stuff blown up. And I'm sorry, but that looks like controlled demolition to me. And then all this nanothermite stuff and blah, blah, and all these ridiculous assumptions that people make about how many millions of pounds of explosives it would take to do it totally. Well, that's just not true. So...
yeah, it's not true at all. In fact, I've done a lot of investigation on this, and it's very clear from many of the videotapes. There's one especially of the tower, I believe it's the North Tower, that came down second, that when you see it finally come down, you see the antennas that are sitting on the main structural support in the middle of the building start to go down just a fraction of a section, second before the rest of the building. That proves that the columns, the 42 columns that were holding up the structure of the building, were actually compromised first. And that, of course, is explained by thermite explosives. They're not really an explosive as much as a burning mechanism that is able to melt down those massive columns at the base. And you tie that in with the witnesses of the janitor about the explosion before the planes hit the tower. the one that blew out all the windows in the lobby. In fact, I've seen a videotape of the firefighters coming into the lobby before the airplane struck it, and all the windows are blown out, and they're talking about it. The firefighters say, look, all the windows are blown. There's been an explosion in here. And, of course, immediately the government shills, the debunkers come in and say, oh, that's because fuel came. Well, remember, this was before the airplane hit. But fuel was supposedly to come down through the main corridor, the utility corridor, and then have exploded. But if that were true, there would have been massive clouds of black smoke and residue of black all through the white ceiling up above. And you see the firefighters pan the ceiling. It's pristine white. There's not a single cloud of black smoke anywhere, and yet all the windows are blasted out.
This is some fascinating stuff. Tell you what, let's take a little break and come back and go farther down a rabbit hole. I like it. John Wells in for George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Our guest tonight is Joel Skousen. Stand by. Our guest, Joel Skousen, in with John B. Wells. That's me in for George Norrie, who has taken a little time off over the holidays. Joel, let me ask something. What, if it's money that controls all of this, even if we identified these people, and in a minute I'm going to ask you if you've identified any of them, if you feel like saying that's fine. If their money becomes worthless, you know, in other words, if we, so to speak, put Mexico on the dollar and we drive our dollar down, just like buying gold. People, I'll buy gold, buy gold, buy gold. And we start off at 400 an ounce. Well, now it's at 1400 an ounce. So you take your $1,400 per ounce gold ingot that you bought some time ago for 400 and you cash it in for dollars that are worthless. How much rope do these people who are really pulling the strings on world government, how much rope do they have? In other words, at some point, do they reach diminishing returns on the kind of clout they'll be able to wield with money that's worth nothing?
The answer is yes. They have a limited extent to which they can continue to play this fiat money game. There is an end to it, and I can predict when that end is coming. Let me describe. First of all, the threat of hyperinflation is not a threat right now. And the reason I say that, we're very much different than Weimar Germany in the sense that we have over $200 trillion outstanding that have been monetized. And that's only a fraction of the amount of dollars that are in contractual form or electronic form, which probably could exceed another $500 trillion. There are $500 trillion in derivatives alone out there outstanding, and no money has ever been printed for that. It's just that someone has promised to pay something that they couldn't possibly pay, and that's fraud, of course. It's a form of insurance fraud, and but that's the game that they're playing, and it has an end game because, first of all, they have a lot more room to inflate than a lot of people think. People keep predicting in 16 months we're going to have the collapse of the dollar. Just not true. With that many trillions of dollars outspread around, people have already traded value for those $200 trillion or $400 trillion, whatever it is. And so they've got value invested in it. They don't want to see that go down. China, for example, could not divest themselves of $800 billion in U.S. bonds that they have without causing the bond price to collapse as they tried to unload them. They would lose everything on two-thirds of their stash if they tried to pull down the dollar. So they have a vested interest to make sure that it doesn't go down fast. So the U.S. has tremendous powers to keep inflating, to bail out, mostly in the speculative economy, their own people. They're the big banks, the people who actually own the Fed. And they can get away with that for quite a bit longer before it ends up to be hyperinflation. Hyperinflation really doesn't begin to get over 20% and above when people start to say, I've got to get rid of this money or it's not going to be worth anything. And you really can't have a Weimar situation in Germany unless you have a mechanism, a structural mechanism for the government to inject money into people's hands every week, every month at payday, which they did in Germany, and they did it through the workers in the Ruhr who were disenfranchised when the French took over the Ruhr, these people went on strike. They weren't going to work for the French, these German workers, and the government started to pay them directly. They started to increase their wages and pump money into them, and then everyone else started to, because inflation was rising, demand money, and literally banks were feeding to corporations, were feeding people. We don't have that structure right now, so that can't happen here unless you start to see stimulus checks being pumped out by Congress every 6 months. The one that did that, the $180 billion in 2008, did end up with a 10% inflation rate in July of 2008, and that shows that you can get high inflation. But even the $4 trillion that the Fed has created in the various bailouts post-TARP only amounted to 1.5% of the existing money supply of dollars. What that means is that's not a hyperinflation rate. That shows the degree to which they can get rid of it. They can spread money around and still not turn into hyperinflation, especially since most of that money, John, goes into the big banks who invested in the speculative economy. It's not going into the real economy. It's not going into investments that earn 8%. It's going into the Forex market and the derivatives market where they can make 10 and 20%. That's why the banks are showing hundreds of billions of dollars of profit. Only the big banks, that is, and nobody else's. There's two different economies operating now. The ones that are on the feeding in at the Fed that can get loans at 0% and invest at 3% and just sit back and rake in the profits, and the rest of the economy be damned. That's what we're dealing with.
So there's a lot of hidden wiggle room with the big boys.
There is, but here's the end game. The end game is that eventually the interest rates have to go up as inflation goes up. Can no longer keep them at zero. And then all of a sudden, the U.S. ceases to have the ability to pay the interest on the debt. Right now, we've got a debt that probably exceeds $40 trillion, real debt, real obligations to the government, simply cannot be paid. It amounts to over $80,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. It's never going to be repaid. The powers that be financially know that. They know there's no way that we can do that. They know that they can't continue to tax. Taxing is very unpopular. You can only tax the rich so much. They already pay 80% of the taxes. And so if you can't tax, the only game you've got in town is continue to deficit spend, but it's got an end game. You can do that up until the point where all of the tax revenues are absorbed by debt payments on the national debt, and then you're bankrupt. And then it's the game's over. That is projected to be approximately 2020 to 2025, depending on the real rate of inflation. I believe very strongly that, and this is part of my general theory, the reason that they've been covering and downplaying the threat of the real enemies, Russia and China, that are out there and fomenting this false terrorist threat to divert people, is that there's going to be a world war someday, and the U.S. itself is going to be attacked. In the aftermath of that, they're going to have an excuse to walk away from the debt because our financial centers are going to be destroyed, the computers are going to go down, and they're going to get out of their bunkers, which they're building, and they're going to say, the Russians deceived us, the Chinese, we didn't know this was going to happen. But, you know, we have to start all over again because the computers are gone. We don't know who owes what. And it's going to be an end game scenario, and they can blame someone else, just like 9/11. Blame the terrorists, blame Afghanistan, blame Iraq, but not us. And you notice not a single person has lost his job because of the, even if they were simply let it happen or even were incompetent, not a single person lost their job. Not a single person loses their job at TSA for all of these exacerbating things.
And unbelievable. On the other side of this top of the hour break, let's get into China and how it is that we're so closely tied to them, and what are we doing business with them for anyway? How did this happen? You can't get a cigar out of Cuba until recently, and everything at Walmart says made in China and everywhere else. John Wells in for George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. We will be back.